Welcome, snack, to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Are you snacking? I wonder if anyone listening to this right now is eating a snack. If so, I hope it's a good one. I hope it's nutritious and delicious. Today we're discussing Karamazov Brothers, Book 5, Chapter 5, Part 1? Wait, that's not right. Part 2. Wait. Is that right? Yes, sorry. I had the wrong page open. Alright. Someone, who was it? Oh, it was Brian E. Denton, linked to an episode of Thug Notes, which was really funny, called The Dark Knight versus the Grand Inquisitor, and helped me to understand what this Grand Inquisitor means. You know, the people need to worship someone. Need to have a hero, an ideal, to keep them enslaved to their morals. You could put it that way. To keep them bound to their morals, maybe is a better word. A leader of some kind. Kind of made sense. It was really good, the Dark Knight analogy, which I found cool. Anyway, the questions that I asked you guys about Book 5, Chapter 5, Part 2 were these. Ivan is clearly in the manic throes of a psychotic episode. Do you think he will get to hospital or somewhere safe before he does harm to himself or some or others? That was clearly me just making a commentary on how poor the dialogue is in this book. But still. Question 2 was, could anyone else stay awake long enough to figure out his point in that 15-minute long pauseless tirade? And also general discussion. I Am Norwegian said, the question in the wilderness is the first temptation of Christ, of turning stones into bread. The Grand Inquisitor is saying that he should have given in to temptation, and humanity would have worshipped Christ through that. Because Christ refused... Oh my God. Because Christ refused, man has to use his mind, his limited and sick consciousness, has to achieve faith, and the Inquisitor thinks that we are not up to the task. I think there's some truth to this. Even people who reject religion often find themselves more dogmatic than they have ever been in political ideology. They find some simplified explanation of the world, some meta-narrative of here are the bad guys and here is the ultimate goal, which they have throughout history worked against, and they work to view everything through that lens and become so staunchly dogmatic that they hand over the gift of freedom which the ill-fated creature is born. Really though? I think... Yeah, I wouldn't really agree with that. Like, I think people do that. Like, construct this kind of lens through which to see the world, but I think they do that in very early adulthood or even teenager sort of years, but then we kind of open up a bit, I think. Like, people do go down the path of like atheism or religion, and I think they lock in further and further into their ideology, but to me it just seems so I don't know, fortified. Like, you're just fortifying this belief because it serves a purpose. You're fortifying a paradigm with denial and cognitive dissonance, and because no one wants to live in the unknown, in chaos. We want to make sense of things, so we attempt to do that, but at a certain point you just kind of acknowledge that you're not meant to make a sense of things, you're meant to make a continual sense of things. It's an ongoing thing, and it should change. Anyway, the whole conversation, as you can probably tell, bores me. I can't stand it. Anyway, when the Inquisitor says, we have corrected thy work and founded it upon miracle, mystery, and authority, is he saying that he is using the three temptations in replacement of freedom to bully people towards God, doing what Jesus expressed? Oh my God. Doing what Jesus expressly refused to do. Is this a criticism of Catholicism by Dostoevsky? I don't know much about Catholicism, but my impression of the reactions to it of people who turned atheist and who then speak of it, i.e. all of Reddit, it does sound like a criticism that still carries some relevance. The smashing of the cup, is that suicidal buffoonery and debauchery? Alyosha plagiarizing Ivan's story right after it was finished by kissing Ivan on the lips made me laugh. This chapter felt slow, but I still enjoyed it. It's something I think I will have to read again someday to fully grasp, but I understand Ivan much better now. Somastars says, I just wanted to point out a possible bit of symbolism in this chapter that may have slipped past modern readers. In prior eras, it was believed that the devil was linked to the left side of the body, hence how being left-handed got a bad rep. When this chapter ends with Alyosha noting that Ivan's left shoulder is raised higher than his right, Dostoevsky is noting that the devil has more power over Ivan than God does. This would seem to be supported by Wikipedia reading on the Grand Inquisitor poem. The summary states, the Inquisitor advances his argument by explaining why Christ was wrong to reject each temptation of Satan. I'm sorry, I'm yawning so much. This is just killing me. The crux of Ivan's poem and the crux of his beliefs, hence the raised left shoulder. If anyone wants to learn more about the devil in the left myth, I can post some resources, or you can Google devil left side. Also, the Wikipedia article linked above is a great quick read for understanding the GI poem, which was a bit of a slog. Uncle Jossel Mayer said, never tell anybody your most cherished and deepest thoughts about God, faith, and religion, because they will be misinterpreted and used against you, and certainly that will give you a psychotic episode, or at least that will leave you with emotional wounds. That because people are at different stages of religious development. I found this Fowler's Faith Stage Theory. Stage 1, ages 3 to 7, intuitive, predictive. Stage 2, 6 to 12, mythical, literal. Stage 3, 12 onwards, synthetic, conventional. Extending faith beyond the family and using this as a vehicle of creating a sense of identity and values. Then stage 4, early adult, individuative reflection. The sense of identity and outlook on the world are differentiated and the person develops explicit systems of meaning. Stage 5, adult, conjunctive. The person faces up to the paradoxes of experience and begins to develop universal ideas and becomes more oriented towards other people. And then stage 6, universalizing. The person becomes totally altruistic and they feel an integral part of an all-inclusive sense of being. This stage is rarely achieved. Cool. I can't really say I've can relate to any of those. None really spring to mind. I know and about probably 19-20 I went through a pretty strong stage of like challenging, not in a religious sense, but other beliefs that I held, and trying to kind of re-justify them, and even like subconscious beliefs or biases or paradigms, just questioning them and putting them through the ringer and seeing what stuck and what changed. It was a very transformative thing that I did at that age. That was an effort. That was like a project to like look at every single paradigm and belief that I held. And I spent years kind of thinking about that and trying to do that. And now I suppose I've continued to do it ad hoc, you could say, as needed, but not religious really. It's more just like, I don't know, functional beliefs. Spitflame said, Ivan is saying that the behavioral standard God set for people is totally unreasonable, which sucks for him because he's a rationalist, meaning he demands a rational explanation for everything. Confronted with unnecessary suffering, he returns the ticket, essentially saying it doesn't matter what God sets as moral, because to him it's immoral. Ivan is giving God the middle finger. Ivan says that he'll endure the suffering through his Karamazov force. Basically everything is permitted, which really paints him in a grey light. Swim said the mama fishy said it's interesting that you used the word manic. Bipolar disorder quite often manifests itself in the early 20s. Ivan is, I believe, 23 or 4 years of age. I have no idea what is going to happen. Yeah, it really does seem like a manic psychotic episode, especially because in the psychotic episode spins out of the schizophrenic personality disorder. Is that what it's called? Schizophrenic something. Anyway, schizophrenic thing. So it's very characterized by like a lot of paranoia. And beyond that, this incredible openness during the manic episode that accompanies a psychotic episode, where information is just flowing in and through their brain at some crazy rate, and they're trying to it's like our brains detect patterns, right? It's really, in a big way, that's what they do best, is determine patterns. And that's how we go from a squishy brained baby that can't do anything to learning a language eventually. We start with patterns. That's why you go with a baby, goo goo goo, ka ka ka. They start pattern recognizing. That's really the first thing their brain can do, is recognize things in patterns. And in the manic episode of the psychotic episode, your brain's pattern recognizing thing, well, not exactly patterns, but it's trying to attribute meaning to everything. So it's looking for links between things in the same way that you might link a pattern together. So everything becomes meaningful, hyper meaningful, and they start linking things that wouldn't necessarily have any link. They're drawing these lines between everything. And in that state of wanting to attribute meaning to everything and every experience, I think the religious texts become very attractive at that point, because even if they're not religious at all and have never shown an interest in the Bible, there's so much in the Bible that you can attribute significance to. It's all very, you know, well, you know what it is, it's all symbolic and it's all vague, and it's all it all suggests that it has a deeper meaning, right? And that's why I think why the psychotic episodes always tend to have this weird religious element to them, even in people who are not remotely religious. So his long religious babble, that's why I keep referring it to, like, reminding me of a psychotic episode, because he's doing that manic talk. He's doing this stream of speech. He doesn't seem to be aware of his audience at all. He'll just talk non-stop for 15 minutes. And it's all jumping around, like there's no coherence to it. And he's circling what he's trying to say for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes before he actually says the thing. You've kind of got to decipher it from what he's saying. And there's so much religious iconography, symbolism, mixed, muddled all through what he's saying. So, I don't know, like if anyone spoke even half as florally and passionately about religion to me, I would assume they're either on drugs or they're having some kind of episode. It's crazy to me that other people just read this book and they're like, oh, they're having a conversation. Like, there's nothing weird about it. It's like, it's insanity. And if Dostoevsky was trying to just write like a normal conversation, he failed so badly, because it's crazy. So I don't know. I don't know what he was trying to do there. I don't know what... I don't understand this book. I really don't understand this book. I cannot understand how people are... what people are getting from it, I suppose. The best thing I can figure is it's like... it's intellectual, and people enjoy things that are intellectual. That's really the only redeeming quality I can think of. It's like it touches on subjects that are potentially interesting. Okay, Question two, swims to the mummifish. He said this succinctly sums up the chapter. What did I say exactly? Oh, could anyone stay awake long enough to figure out his point in this 15-minute long pauseless tirade? Thank you, that does succinctly sum up the chapter. The story of the Grand Inquisitor is an allegory for the difference between Ivan and Alyosha's worldviews. Like Ivan, the Grand Inquisitor only wants peace and happiness for mankind. He disagrees with Christ, however, about how to achieve this goal. Even though Ivan and Alyosha disagree, they both want the same thing. Right, so they both want the greater good, and for people to be, happiness of mankind. Peace and happiness. Okay, that's a goal, I suppose. I don't think peace or happiness... Peace is good. Happiness... It's a funny word to describe what you want. You know, I think you would prefer meaning. Having meaning in your life is more important than happiness. I think anyone who says, like, the aim of life is to be happy and they just want to be happy and these things, they're either using happy as a stand-in word for, like, meaningful, or if they genuinely mean, like, smiles and laughs, that's the only thing that matters, then I think they're rather mistaken. You know, imagine your, I don't know, what gives you the most meaning, like a vocation, you know, you're doing your thing. I'm trying to think of an example. I don't know, let's say you do something really meaningful with your life, and you're in the middle of it, and you're really engaged, and you're like, yes, this is great, this is going to make such a difference. And if someone came up to you in that moment and saw you concentrating and you're so engaged and you're just blocking out everything else and were like, smile, buddy, you'd be like, piss off. Like, I'm not sad right now. It's not that I'm, you know, unhappy, but I am concentrating on something more important at the moment than giving you a smile. And if you ask them, what would you rather do, smile right now or complete this very meaningful task, which one would actually make you feel better? I think most people would say completing the meaningful task rather than just smiling meaninglessly. So what we want is for people, if you want the best for someone, you want them to find something that they can achieve that will feel meaningful to them. Question three, I'm ready to move on for a while from all this discussion of faith and doubt, free will and determinism, miracles, mysteries and authority, churches that have now embraced Satan for the supposed good of the people, a metaphorical kiss to you all. Yep, I would love like some story to happen in this book, like a story. You know when you read a book and it's got like a story that happens? Not just characters explaining their religious beliefs. It would be cool if, like, they did something that demonstrated their religious beliefs, not just talking about them at length. I think that might be asking too much. I just feel like the rest of this book is just going to be them wanking, masturbating to each other about what they believe. But hey, I might be pleasantly surprised. Let's continue the book. We're going to read the first half of... what are we up to? Book 5, Chapter 6. I'm going to break that one down into two parts as well. Just let me find my page here. In the meantime, in between time, I will just keep talking so that there's no dead air. And also other things that do things and stuff, etc. And so on and so forth. I've lost my page, and I don't know what page it was. Oh, hang on, I found it. Okay, what are we up to? Book 5, Chapter 6, Part 1. Chapter 6 is called For a While, a Very Obscure One. And Ivan, on parting from Alyosha, went home to Fyodor Pavlovich's house. But strange to say, he was overcome by insufferable depression, which grew greater at every step he took towards the house. There was nothing strange in his being depressed. What was strange was that Ivan could not have said what was the cause of it. He had often been depressed before, and there was nothing surprising at his feeling, So, at such a moment, when he had broken off with everything had brought him here, and was preparing that day to make a new start and enter upon a new unknown future, he would again be a solitary, as ever, excuse me. And though he had great hopes and great, too great, expectations from life, he could not have given any definite account of his hopes, his expectations, or even his desires. Yet at that moment, though, the apprehension of the new and unknown certainty found place in his heart, what was worrying him was something quite different. Is it loathing for my father's house? He wondered. Quite likely, I'm so sick of it. And though it's the last time I shall cross its hateful threshold, I still loathe it. No, it's not that either. Is it the partying with Alyosha and the conversation I had with him? For so many years I've been silent with the whole world and not deigned to speak, and all of a sudden I reel off a rigmarole like that. Certainly it might have been the youthful vexation of youthful experience and vanity, vexation at having failed to express himself, especially with such a being as Alyosha, on whom his heart had certainly been reckoning. No doubt that came in, that vexation, it must have done indeed, but yet that was not it. That was not it, either. I feel sick with depression, and yet I can't tell what I want. Better not think, perhaps. Ivan tried not to think, but that too was no use. What made his depression so vexatious and irritating was that it had a kind of casual, external character. He felt that. Some person or thing seemed to be standing out somewhere, just as someone will sometimes obtrude itself upon the eye, and though one may be so busy with work or conversation that for a long time one does not notice it, yet it irritates and almost torments one till at last one realizes and removes the offending object, often quite a trifling and ridiculous one, some article left about in the wrong place, a handkerchief on the floor, a book not replaced on the shelf, and so on. At last, feeling very cross and ill-humoured, Ivan arrived home, and suddenly, about 15 paces from the garden, he guessed what was fretting and worrying him. On a bench in the gateway, the valet Smerdyakov was sitting enjoying the coolness of the evening, and, at the first glance at him, Ivan knew that the valet Smerdyakov was on his mind, and that it was this man that his soul loathed. It all dawned upon him suddenly and became clear. Just before, when Alyosha had been telling him of his meeting with Smerdyakov, he had felt a sudden twinge of gloom and loathing, which had immediately stirred responsive anger in his heart. Afterwards, as he talked, Smerdyakov had been forgotten for the time, but still he had been in his mind, and as soon as Ivan parted with Alyosha and was walking home, the forgotten sensation began to obtrude itself again. Is it possible that a miserable, contemptible creature like that can worry me so much? He wondered, with insufferable irritation. It was true that Ivan had come of late to feel an intense dislike for the man, especially during the last few days. He had even begun to notice in himself a growing feeling that was almost of hatred for the creature. Perhaps this hatred was accentuated by the fact that when Ivan first came to the neighbourhood he had felt quite differently. Then he had taken a marked interest in Smerdyakov and had even thought him very original. He had encouraged him to talk to him, although he had always wondered at a certain incoherence or rather restlessness in his mind, and could not understand what it was that so continually and insistently worked upon the brain of the contemplative. They discussed philosophical questions and even how there could have been light on the first day when the sun, moon, and stars were all only created on the fourth day.
Oh, my God.
And how that was to be understood. As soon as I start talking about religion, I start yawning again. Oh, God. But Ivan soon saw that though the moon, sun, and stars might be an interesting subject, yet that it was quite secondary to Smerdyakov, and that he was looking for something altogether different. In one way and another, he began to betray a boundless vanity, and he wounded vanity too, and that Ivan disliked. It had first given rise to his aversion. Later on, there had been trouble in the house. Grushenka had come on the scene, And there had been the scandals with the brothers Dmitri. They discussed that too, but though Smerdyakov always talked of that with great excitement, it was impossible to discover what he desired to come of it. There was, in fact, something surprising in the illogicality and incoherence of some of his desires, accidentally betrayed and always vaguely expressed. Smerdyakov was always inquiring, putting certain indirect but obviously premeditated questions, but what his object was he did not explain, and usually at the most important moment he would break off and relapse into silence or pass to another subject. But what finally irritated Ivan most and confirmed his dislike for him was the peculiar revolting familiarity which Smerdyakov began to show more and more markedly. Not that he forgot himself and was rude, on the contrary, he always spoke very respectfully, yet he had obviously begun to consider goodness knows why that there was some sort of understanding between him and Ivan Fyodorovitch. He always spoke in a tone that suggested that these two had some kind of compact, some secret between them, and that had at some time been expressed on both sides, only known to them and beyond the comprehension of those around him, them. But for a long while Ivan did not recognize the real cause of his growing dislike, and he had only lately realized what was at the root of it. Okay, he's dreading going into the house because Smerdyakov's there. Like, that was 2 pages describing that his dislike for Smerdyakov. You could say it in, I don't know, 1/10 of that. This is the worst book. Alright, that's going to do us for today. We'll finish this chapter tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.